Who are these people? I'm talking about the academics that seemingly spring from nowhere to become famous authors. Their books become legends. Their books are made into films, TV shows, and plays. Their books are used in schools where children are told this is what real literary talent is. Their books change cultures, they change attitudes over generations, even centuries. In this series, we have discussed many people who are linked in some way to the Huxleys, none more so than Eric Blair, aka George Orwell. When we say the phrase, "we live in Orwellian times," we all know the connotations of what that means. Orwell's work has influenced lives generation after generation. Social engineering at its best. A question we ask is, did he actually exist? Was he a figment of the imagination set out by the security agencies? George Orwell, an enigma. Why was he, or what was written in his name, so important that it is still used today? Also, his books, Animal Farm and 1984, like Aldous Huxley's Brave New World, sum up what we're living through now, exactly. When I look into these people, you can clearly see that it is a setup, a scam, a sleight of hand. To put it simply, Blair, stroke Orwell, his undercover name, was a security asset, even if he did exist. These people are placed in magazines that are fronts themselves for MI6 and CIA setups to give their work a semblance of credibility. These people go to the right schools. They are the 1% of the 1% of the 100%. But they all share things in common. In these individuals or families, we can see the threads of the matrix via the bloodlines. We see the outlines of a blurry picture materializing. The faceless parasitical matrix uses these individuals and their skill sets as weapons that have been set against us all. Whether these people know it or not, maybe they're being used either unknowingly or against their wishes, it makes no difference. They are part of or working for the dark side. These individuals plant seeds or future spells to come true in the minds of the sleeping NPCs. You're listening to Sheep Farm's Huxley's Brave New World Order series. This is episode 4 and will be in two parts, so it'll take up episodes 4 and 5. As always, all the information comes from mainstream sources. I'd like to thank Lorraine for her help and my wife for putting up with my endless hours of research. Just who are these flockers?
As we all know, the biological and social stimulation of the family leads to private reflection outside party needs.
I or thoughtfully.
Unorthodox loyalties which can only lead to thought crime.
Strength and youth are sacrificed. Who are you?
There are thought criminals who maintain that resistance is not real. Believe me, Winston.
Group, take your places, please.
Double plus goodness. Dinner. I didn't think there's a single piece of meat in this, dear.
You knew this would happen, sir.
The individual is only a cell.
All right, welcome back. This is episode 4 of Sheep Farm Meet the Flockers series of Huxley's Brave New World Order. This was only going to be about 30 minutes of episode 3, but now we're on episode 4, and this is probably going to be two episodes in itself. We're going to be talking about Eric Blair, a.k.a. George Orwell. And as I said, these presentations will be in two parts. Orwell is a bit of an enigma, and this presentation is going to be called, or the part one is going to be called, Mockingbirds. As we saw in episode 3, The Doors of Perception, nothing is what it seems, and everything is controlled, or at least the attempt is made to try and control everything. George Orwell, seemingly from a lower upper middle class stock, which is how they've explained him, which seems a bit strange, is portrayed as anti-establishment, anti-totalitarian, and for the rights of the working class people. I would say he's more or less the entire opposite, but anyway. He was anti-communist, anti-fascist, pro-freedom, but nothing could be further from the truth. He worked for the intelligence services, and he had the right bloodlines, as we'll see in episode 2. We'll see partly in this episode as well. Sorry, in episode 5. Orwell wrote about the barn wall in Animal Farm and was part of the writing of the barn wall in reality. That's why we've called this episode Mockingbirds. And it's dedicated to George Orwell. Although it's not all about George Orwell, there will be some crossovers as well. Whilst writing and researching this Huxley's Brave New World Order series, it dawned on me what the Matrix is doing. For years, we've talked about predictive programming and the revelation of method and these evildoers needing to tell us what they're going to do in advance for some kind of karmic recourse. Well, here it is. How do individuals like Huxley, Orwell, and H.G. Wells and people like that know what's going to happen years in advance? The planning is done decades, generations, even centuries ahead of time, before these people are even born. It's virtually impossible to have a crystal ball to and write down what you think is going to happen. But these individuals seem to be able to predict the future like savants. They write books about it, and kids are told about it in schools around the world, and then it happens, just like that. But how do they know or get this knowledge? Are they geniuses? Is it passed to them by secret dark occult groups or given to them by frequency technologies? The truth is, though, that their fiction has a habit of coming true. And we plebs have a bad habit of equating riches and material gain to success. This just isn't true. Yes, most of these people are of a certain class, but a lot of them are not the multi-billionaires that we think are the success stories. They have cult-level devotion as well to the cause, and they do have the right bloodlines running through them. That's no doubt. We always see that. And this goes above religion. You know, a lot of people blame a certain religion for everything, namely the Jewish people. And I don't buy that one. After doing this research, I don't buy that it's all about that priest class. I don't think that at all. And I'm sure our Chris agrees with me. I think when we look at this bloodline, there is all of these people are involved in it for some reason. It is like the Prometheus bloodline. Success seems to be measured by cultural and genetic changes in the population, just as much as financial gain and control. Before we start, I'd like to thank my friend and fellow researcher Lorraine for helping me with some of the finer details of this research, because some of it came out of nowhere. And I want to make it clear that this episode and the next episode will probably not contain every bit of information about George Orwell or evidence linked to Orwell, but what it will show blatantly is that Orwell was an obvious agent of the state. All information is taken from the mainstream and we make no wild claims. It's up to you to make your own conclusions. We just follow the evidence trail left by the Matrix by looking back in time. So Chris, welcome. Thoughts on anything you took out of that intro?
Well, I've always been a fan of George Orwell. I mean, even before I went down the conspiratorial rabbit hole, if you like, and I've read most of his stuff. I've read 1984 a number of times, and even more recently, An Animal Farm. But I also read his Wigan Pier one, where he was down the pit. I didn't read all that, actually. I'm telling a lie there. But I did read the Down and Out in Paris and London,
right,
which I quite enjoyed because it's being a chef. It was about him working in kitchens at some point, which I found interesting anyway. But something that's always bothered me about Orwell is there's only one or two photos of him. And like you said, there's no audio or video of him. Because we looked some years ago, actually. I think even before previous nonsense, I remember you and talking about it. Because I think we found one film, didn't we? But it was an acted film doing his life story.
Yeah, well, that actor, I forget his name now, but we'll talk about him in a bit.
Yeah.
Well, further on in this, I think this episode.
But we talked about some time ago whether he actually even exists. Because like I said, there's only a couple of photos. And from what we've talked about more recently, while you've been doing this research, is he seems like a character who's been made up or he's been put into certain positions so he can be the guy who writes 1984.
The Mockingbird.
Mm. Yeah. Very interesting, though. It's almost like they tried to make him out to be working class, you know, joining these certain groups and stuff, fighting for the working class kind of thing. But as always, I mean, it can't be a coincidence that his two books are in all the schools and kids are told to read them, students are told to read them, like The Brave New World. Yeah. Why are some of these books lauded up to be these, you know, strokes of genius?
Yeah, I mean, we read, I know it's slightly different, we read Roald Dahl's as well. All these people that we're reading, and as we're seeing, like the music industry, that the guys have researched, Mark Devlin, Mike Williams, Dave McGowan, etc., Crow 777, they're all links back to some kind of military or military intelligence, as we showed with the Dawes episode. And this is the same. Roald Dahl were intelligent.
Well, also, like anything, you're told what to read, aren't you? You're told what music to like. You're told what films are the best films, you know, and they cover every angle, don't they? And like I said before, if it's in Waterstones as you walk in, it's there for a reason, isn't it?
You know? But going back to, and we are going to hit on this bit, that there are no, and it's, no known audio recordings or film of George Orwell. And we're going to call him George Orwell all the way through this, not Eric Blair. Bear in mind, he worked for the BBC for 2 years during the war. And talking about propaganda, and he was working for the BBC delivering this propaganda. The pictures that are shown of him, I have to say, there's a few pictures out there, and some of them look slightly like the different person, in my opinion, but I'm not an expert on images, but they do look a little bit different. And I just find it hard to believe that he's got a pic. There's a famous picture of him with one of those old microphones. I'll put it up now if you're watching this, not listening to it on the podcast, of him with a BBC microphone.
Yeah, I've seen that. Yeah.
And why haven't they recorded that? I personally think that's a bit of a setup, but why wouldn't they record that? There's no reason not to. And I can't believe that one of the most famous authors in time, there's no recordings of him. Aldous Huxley's the same. There's only a few recordings of Aldous Huxley. There is more than Orwell.
There's that famous one, isn't there, where he does that big long speech?
Yes, yeah, at the university. One at the university, and there's one at the beginning of the first episode that we did where he's interviewed, and it's all black and white and weird, and they're all the smoking while they're talking and all that type of stuff. But yeah, and there's no way we could cover every area of his work, but hopefully we'll cover enough in these two presentations for you to get a picture of who he actually was. And did he exist?
I kind of think he did, but he's just, we've been given a version of that story. That's what I would guess at, but I don't know.
Yeah.
But how did he go about writing a book in 1948 about TV screens watching you, which is what we're doing right now, I suppose. Yeah. You know. But unlike his version of events, we're actually paying for it rather than it being forced upon us.
Well, again, like I said in that intro, it's strange how these people are telling us what's going to happen, and it happens 54, whatever, 75 years ahead, doesn't it? It's a strange phenomenon. Anyway, we'll move on. So I want to start Operation Mockingbird. I've called this Mockingbird, and the reason is obvious. Operation Mockingbird recruited leading American journalists into propaganda networks and influenced the operations of front groups. CIA support of front groups was exposed when an April 1967 Ramparts article reported that the National Student Association received funding from the CIA. Shock and horror. In 1973, a document referred to as the Family Jewels was published by the CIA containing a reference to Project Mockingbird, which was the name of an operation in 1963 wiretapping two journalists believed to be disseminating classified information. Deborah Davis wrote in her book, Catherine the Great, in 1979, an unauthorized biography of Catherine Graham, owner of the Washington Post, that the CIA ran an Operation Mockingbird during this time, writing that the Prague-based International Organization of Journalists, the IOJ, received money from Moscow and controlled reporters on every major newspaper in Europe. Disseminating stories that promoted the communist cause, and that Frank Wisner, director of the Office of Policy Coordination, had created Operation Mockingbird in response. Tom O'Neill's book about the Manson murders has shown that there was operations running to recruit members of the arts, academics, entertainment, and business, etc., to help control whatever narrative was required for the time. I don't think that can be really argued against now, can it? Well, it can be, but I think it'd be foolish to argue against it, wouldn't it, Chris?
Yeah. Right. I mean, the old Manson nonsense was just, as I think I mentioned before, I remember seeing some in the headier days of YouTube, some video of when they raided that his ranch, you know, the Manson ranch, and all the cops were dressed in like Hollywood stage outfits.
Yeah.
Someone were pointing out, and they all had different, none of the outfits matched what was going on and where they were. They were in the wrong places.
Yeah, well, when you see Tom O'Neill talk about that, and when you read it in his book about how they actually, they arrested them and just let them go. Said they didn't have anything on them. So they had helicopters flying over. I forget how many coppers were floating around. And
he said there were choppers flying all over Hollywood at that time for weeks and weeks. Everyone was terrified. And who is it? Steve McQueen was. They're all carrying revolvers on the hip and stuff because they
thought they were next. Yeah.
Yeah. So the same fear bullshit as we've seen numerous times since, I suppose.
Yeah. And Orwell. If the character exists, it might have been again. George Orwell might have been like James Bond, for argument's sake. Several different characters playing the character.
Well, imagine how easy it'd have been to hide that if you had numerous people playing him, or if he didn't exist, or whatever. Imagine how easy it'd be to hide in 1948.
Yeah, especially since there's hardly any.
They can do it now.
Pictures, audio, video of him. There's the Orwell Society, though, Chris, and the Orwell Foundation. selling the dream, as usual.
Orwell Foundation.
I think there's the Orwell, something like the Orwell Foundation or something like that. There's a few charities floating around that's run by his, and I'll come on to them later on, run by his son, Orwell and his first wife, Eileen O'Shaughnessy Blair, adopted.
Right. All right, they adopted a son, didn't they?
Yeah. Richard, I think he was called. And Orwell was either a controlled entity, either with or without his knowledge, or he willingly worked for intelligence services. My money's on the latter because of the people that were around him. Like Tony Blair, who I can't believe escaped all those pedos at them two schools. I can't believe he escaped all these intelligence agents who were around him at the time.
What do you think, knowingly or unknowingly?
Knowingly. If George Orwell, the person, that's my view. I'm not saying I'm right. I'm just saying that there were too many intelligence agents around for, I mean, 1980, let me get this right. Animal Farm, they sold the rights to the CIA.
Right.
Animal Farm to make the animated film.
So the CIA made the film?
CIA made the film. They funded the film.
Bloody hell.
Right. 1984, the Information Research Department, or some promotion, I think. So what I'm trying to say is that...
Sounds just, like an Orwellian company.
There's involvement with these clandestine intelligence agencies to push his work after he died.
Because he died quite young. He was in his 40s, wasn't he?
Yeah, well, he died in 1950.
So and a few people died. 1984.
Yeah, well, his wife died quite suddenly. First wife. And he died suddenly. And another guy who will come on to, who was with him when he went to the Spanish Civil War.
Yeah.
A Belgian guy. I think he was Belgian. He died quite suddenly as well. There are a lot of people disappearing quite suddenly. And a lot of other people around him, like the Cambridge Five spy ring and stuff like that, he knew all these people. One of them were his teacher.
Right.
At Eton.
What, who died suddenly?
No, one of the fifth member of the Cambridge Five Soviet spy ring.
Right, bloody hell.
So I want to come on to Orwell's books. And the reason I want to come on, I thought I'd have a look at the publishers. Just to see who the publishers are. And especially for his books, Animal Farm and 1984, Orwell is best remembered for his political commentary as a left-wing anti-totalitarian. I said that in the intro. As he explained in an essay, Why I Write, in 1946.
It's funny, I got that geeked out with Orwell years and years ago when I first... No, I didn't read Orwell at school because I wasn't smart enough. I was thick class. Yeah. But I read it when I left school.
What was school?
Yeah, exactly. I think I've got all his books. I think there's a few I ain't got. One of his, I think that one where he worked in a bookshop. But I've got that one with a series of essays, Why I Write. And I was just thinking about it when you were talking.
Right.
I've even read that. I got that geeked out and read it all.
Well, that's good. A lot of this stuff will come back to you as we're going through.
Yeah,
this, I'm sure.
Yeah, I've definitely read that one. I remember reading it.
So this essay, one of the lines from this essay was, every line of serious work that I've written since 1936 has been written directly or indirectly against totalitarianism and for democratic socialism, as I understood it. So if he's a socialist in them times, in the Cold War, if the Cold War were real, like we were told it was, would he, and I'll keep coming back to this point, would he really be working for the Information Research Department, and would he be put on BBC radio to push the military operation, well, the military might of the British Army in World War II?
No. No, not at all.
Would he... Yeah, anyway. So Orwell's books were published by... He had three publishers, and I'm going to go into two of them here because the other one only published one of them. I think that was the American one. You might remember these, Chris, if you've read all his books. Victor Golanz, spell limited, spell G-O-L-L-A-N-C-Z, was a major British book publishing house of the 20th century and continues to publish science fiction and fantasy titles as an imprint of Orion Publishing Group. Sir Victor Golanz, who was born in 1893, died in 1967, was a British publisher and humanitarian. Golanz was known as a supporter of left-wing policies. His loyalties shifted between liberalism and communism. He defined himself as a Christian socialist and an internationalist. It's like a globalist, surely. A spin-off publisher set up by Golanz was the Left Book Club, a publishing group that exerted a strong left-wing influence in Great Britain from 1936 to 1948. Now, if you think about that, you've got a guy here who's got a publishing company who's publishing left-wing material right under the noses, in probably in London, of the intelligence community. I don't think he's going to be left alone personally, do you?
Or he's there to be left alone.
Yes, or he's there to be left alone. And he's knighted.
Right.
Kitchen.
We know who he's working for.
Yeah. Pioneered by Victor Golanz, sounds like that guy that invented razors, doesn't it? Toothbrushes. It offered a monthly book choice for sale to members only, as well as a newsletter that required the status of a major political magazine. Victor Golanz worked for Ernest Benn Limited, founded by Sir John Williams Benn, 1st Baronet, and father of politician William Wedgwood Benn, also known as 1st Viscount Stansgate. So that's Tony Benn.
Right.
Yeah. So Tony Benn was also known as Viscount Stansgate, but he was an active member of the Fabian Society and served as chairman from 1964 to 1965. The Huxleys are also married into the Wedgwood family, and the Pisas, Darwins, Arnolds, and Galtons, and many more. The Wedgwoods and Arnolds are also founders of the Fabian Society, as we mentioned in episode one.
Hmm.
So Victor Golanz and Victor Golanz Limited would have been on the Security Forces register during the Cold War, as would any of the works that they published. Orwell published five books under this publisher. His first book that you mentioned, Down and Out in Paris and London in 1933.
Hmm.
A Clergyman's Daughter, 35. Keep the Aspidistra Flying, 1936. The Road to Wigan Pier, 1937. And Coming Up for Air, 1939. Victor Golanz, what did you say?
No, I was going to say, I didn't read them other ones. I think they were fiction, weren't they?
Yeah. Right. Victor Golanz was far left and probably a communist. Why would Orwell, with his anti-totalitarian views, work for this publisher? Interesting, Victor Golanz Limited also published books for David John Moore Cornwell, also known as John Le Carre, who in the 1950s and 60s worked for both the Security Service, MI5, and the Secret Intelligence Service, MI6. I find that a lot of these book companies also published a lot of people who had worked for security, like Fleming's books and people.
Yeah. Was he openly MI5, MI6, John Le Carre?
Well...
Is he admitted, I mean?
I got that from his Wikipedia page.
Right, there you go.
Right?
Yeah.
And obviously it's said in other areas as well. And I sort of knew that myself because I've read, I've read quite a few of his books.
I've read a couple of his books.
A bit like when we looked into Robert Ludlum, for argument's sake. Yeah. He was...
But it also adds that edge to his books, doesn't it? Because people go, oh, you know, we're really in Secret Service, and then it's real, that's what happens, etc. Yeah. Like Ian Fleming, you know, he were part of MI6. So it adds that gravitas to James Bond.
I mean, would you say he had to get permission with some of the stuff they wrote about? Because, I mean, it were very close to...
Well,
reality,
I would reckon. Well,
that's John Le Carré. That is not.
Yeah.
Orwell.
Yeah. Except for the fact that the Cold War was just a fucking bullshit war, wasn't it?
Yeah.
I'm sure people were killing each other. But I thought, yeah, definitely. I think he was definitely put out there to do what he did. John Le Carré would.
That's why they call them genres. I think because we've got to have somebody doing that. We've got to have some same with music, same with TV. Mm. They're all got genres. Same with sport. What are you into, football or rugby?
But
you've got to have a genre.
The spy novels, you know, they're quite exciting. I mean, I've read a couple of genres.
Yeah, I used to read them, didn't I? That stuff. Yeah. So one of his other publishing companies was Secker and Warburg, John Frederick Warburg and Roger Senhouse. Harville Secker, a British publishing company formed in 2005 from the merger of Secker and Warburg and Harville Press. Secker and Warburg was formed from a takeover of a company called Martin Secker, which was in receivership, and it was saved by Frederick Warburg and Roger Senhouse. The firm became famous or renowned for its political stance being both anti-fascist and anti-communist. So his work is signed for a pro-communist, and now he's working for an anti-communist.
I was going to say as well, Fatty, just quickly, before I forget, sorry, I should have said it earlier, but the other one, the other guy, it's funny that he had to join to get the books as well. If you joined...
Yeah, membership.
Yeah, but I mean, that's tracing whoever joined.
Yeah.
Sure.
Well, quite possibly.
To an extent. Yeah.
Maybe he wanted it the other way around to keep people's information secret.
Well, version of data collection.
Sir Victor Gallant.
he were known that they used to watch libraries for certain books to go out to track who took out them books.
Yeah.
So I'm guessing the MI5, MI6 did the same thing.
Mm. No doubt. If it came
to
a left
wing, your only access was a library to get a book that you probably wouldn't be able to buy.
Again, it comes back to that Mockingbird. Where are these people stationed, these sentinels that they're set on? The Harville Press was founded in 1946 by Manya Harari. It'd be interesting to see if she's related to Yuval Harari. And Marjorie Villiers, fourth child and youngest daughter of Jewish financier called Grigory Benningsen, whose grandson, Peter Benningsen, served in the intelligence corps at the Ministry of Information and worked at Bletchley Park during World War II in the testry. So he was breaking codes for the intelligence services while his grandmother was setting up a book company that was signing all these anti-fascist and anti-communist book writers that were signing on communist book writers like George Orwell.
Mm. Well, I mean, these early authors, and I mean, you could say that the authors of these books were the directors, and the book companies were the producers, and the money behind these directors. What I mean is, if you compare it to modern day, where they're making films, it's propagandizers. I mean, that's what they had, isn't it? They had newspapers and books.
Yeah, that were their social media, wasn't it?
Before films became a big thing.
This Peter Benningsen is listed as RSM Benningsen in room 41 as a cryptographer and served with Donald Mickey, Susan Mickey's father, who worked with Alan Turing. So all these people are all interlinked. We're going to talk about Alan Turing. It was going to be in this episode, but this has gone on that long. It's going to have to be in episode 6. Where we talk about Alan Turing, because there's a link back there to, and this is the link, I'll tell you the link. We're going to go into more detail on that ancestry. In 1952, John Frederick Warburg became a member of the Committee of the Society for Cultural Freedom, the SCF, an organisation established, in the words of Warburg's friends, T.R. Favel, to promote Western culture and defend it against the communist culture of the East. Sounds like an intelligence setup to me. Mm. The SCF produced cultural magazines, Encounter, that's what it was called, which received sustained criticism in the 1960s when it it emerged that much of the money used to produce the magazine had come directly from the CIA, without the knowledge of most of its contributors and supporters, including Warburg. And that is Mockingbird in a nutshell, innit? You've got a guy who sets up his own book company, is producing these books that are read by school kids, and he doesn't know that the CIA is funding it. Yeah. And when he finds out, he can't say out, can he? It's too late.
Yeah, it's funny, talk about killing your heroes. I mean, like I said, I always liked George Orwell. Like the way he wrote, and yeah, I liked his essays. And
it's a right letdown, this work, isn't it? I mean, thankfully, the Doors weren't my heroes. So,
no, but yeah, yeah. I've got a copy of, look, even Mrs. bought me one of those, you know, those posh folio versions of 1984. I've got right, like three copies of it.
Right.
You know, one of those big...
Hey, the book, like, the book, it tells you what's happening. You can't knock this. But
that's good.
Again, I mean, I'm not a Beatles fan, but like some of the Beatles music was expertly written.
Yeah, yeah.
You can't deny it.
I'm
because
not
it was written
fan.
By experts.
Yeah, yeah. I'll tell you something funny about Beatles, fire. Just as a side note, I went to my mate Dave's house once, and he was saying how much he loved the Beatles. His dad's a big Beatles fan. And I said, I'm not a fan. Anyway, put them on. We were sat boozing or whatever, and he put them on for a few hours just in the background. The next day, I could not get them out of my head.
Yeah.
I could not lose them, honestly, for a day. It was just
comes
stuck
back to
in
that Twilight language.
Yeah, yeah. It was stuck in my head for ages.
Yeah.
I could not get rid of it. And I am not a Beatles fan whatsoever.
No, I've got to say, some of the tunes, obviously, are catchy. I wouldn't have been...
Yeah, of course, yeah.
Yeah.
Not my bag, though.
Yeah. The magazine that we were talking about that were funded by the CIA, Encounter, was a literary magazine founded in 1953 by poet Sir Stephen Harold Spender, CBE. After the war, Spender became a member of the Allied Control Commission, restoring civil authority in Germany. With Cyril Connolly, who we're going to come on to in a bit, and Peter Watson, Spender co-founded another magazine, Horizon, that I will be mentioning later on, that published Orwell's early articles / essays. Spender served as its editor from 1939 to 1941. He resigned after it emerged that the Congress for Cultural Freedom, which published it, was covertly funded by the CIA.
They're all over it, aren't they?
All over it. They're all over it. They're not going to leave it alone, either. They already admitted that they were basically taking over all news press in the 1960s.
Like I said, fight, imagine how easy it was in them days. Imagine how easy it was compared to now.
Yeah.
You've got all those lunatics watching everything everyone does. There's a
theme running through this, or one of the themes running through this, is a lot of these people, because it's a bit of an arty-farty, the author land, yeah, and poets and stuff like that, it seems to be a lot of these people are gay.
Right.
So obviously in the 40s, 30s, 40s, 50s, 60s,
they've got something to hold them.
They've got leverage. And one of the things that comes out of this is not only is Orwell surrounded by people in the intelligence community, he's also surrounded by people of importance in his life who are gay.
Right. Well, like you said, leverage is there, isn't it? I mean, now you've got to be a bloody satanic paedophile to have any leverage. Now being gay would mean nothing. You wouldn't have anything on anyone. But then even going back to the 80s, it was still a big thing, wasn't it?
Yeah. So you've got this guy called Spender. He was a professor of English at the University College London, UCL, from 1970 to 77. And he worked for a magazine that was funded by the CIA. And that, again, is Mockingbird in full effect. You've got a guy throughout the 50s and 60s who are running probably operations or being funded underneath by the CIA. He then now retires from that magazine, that life, but he's working in a college recruiting students to start doing the work. It's like a giant pyramid selling operation, isn't it?
Well, I remember finding out years and years ago, being in, you know, like in art and stuff, that Jackson Pollock was a CIA funded. You know, and I'm
it's devastating, isn't it, when you find people that you actually
when I found
respect
that out,
and like. Yeah.
Well, when I found that out when I was younger, I thought, "What? That didn't make any sense at all." But they were creating art that's not art, I suppose.
Yeah. But again, it comes back to that worship of mediocrity. Mm. Who better to fund, right, right, you can't play bass, you can't play guitar, you can't play drums, Ringo, but you're going to be famous, yeah? You're going to be worth $500 million in 20, 30, 40 years' time. Just do what we say.
Well,
which young kid at 20-year-old would argue against that?
No, I wouldn't.
I don't think anybody would.
And if you think about Jackson Pollock, you've got art and, you know, figure, all this stuff, and he basically became famous. Well, whatever you think of him, regardless what you think of him, he was funded by CIA, apparently. Yeah. And he became famous for splatting paint on a canvas.
Yeah.
And, you know, you can say whatever, but...
I could have done that. And I'm shite at drawing.
But yeah, I suppose that was one of the beginnings of modern art, wasn't it?
Yeah.
And you're taking away figurative drawing and skill to a guy who splats paint on a canvas.
Mm.
Regardless what you think of him. I mean, I've seen some of his paintings. They are quite striking, whatever. But he's still paint splattered on a canvas.
Yeah. At the end of the
I always
day.
Remember our mate Dougie going to... He took Seb to my son to Tate Modern when he was really little. And is it, I think it's, I forget who he is now. Is it, who is it who paints some blue squares? It's not Rothko, is it? Blue squares.
Don't talk to me about artists at the club.
And they're all looking at this blue square. Apparently this guy, I've forgotten his name now, he uses a certain blue, etc. And Seb, being like 6-year-old, went, why is everyone staring at that blue square? And everyone kind of shuffled off from the mouth of babes.
Yeah. Frederick Warburg, his partner. And now Warburg, where have I heard that name before? Ah, Warburg family, the German and American banking family noted for their varied accomplishments in biochemistry, botany, political activism, economics, investment banking, law, physics, classical music, art, history, pharmacology, physiology, finance, private equity, and philanthropy. Like the Warburg banking family, Frederick John Warburg's ancestors originated from Hamburg, Germany. Small world, innit? They all come from the same place. One of his ancestors was Samuel Moses Frankfurter Warburg. That Frankfurt gene running thick. From Hamburg. Frankfurter from Hamburg. Who goes back to the 1500s to a town called Warburg. And yeah, I have looked into him. I know I'm a bit sad, but there you go. The other co-founder of Harville Secker, or Secker Warburg, was Roger Henry Pocklington Senhouse, member of the Bloomsbury Group, which is another thing we'll be talking about. Have you heard of the Bloomsbury Group? Group of writers that were around...
Well, Bloomsbury is a publisher, isn't it?
Yeah, but Bloomsbury Group were a group of writers, also known as the Bloomsbury Set,
right,
whom Aldous Huxley was close to. The Bloomsbury Group member, Lytton Strachey, revealed that Senhouse, was his last lover, and with whom, in the late 20s and early 1930s, he had a sadomasochistic sexual relationship. And again, there's a theme through this. I'm not having to dig very deep to find this information out, you know? Mm. You do have to follow like the trails of these people, but you tend to find that there's an intelligence link, and they're having these types of relationships when it was illegal.
I'm going to say it. Sadomasochism, I mean, now it's becoming basically mainstream, isn't it? I suppose.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. So just to clarify, the Congress of Cultural Freedom was an anti-communist propaganda group founded on the 26th of June 1950 in West Berlin, and was supported by the CIA and its allies. At its height, the CCF was active in 35 countries. In 1966, it was revealed that the CIA was instrumental in the establishment and funding of the group. There were a lot of... I started looking into that group, but that was another pit to go down. This episode weren't about that. But it looked like the World Economic Forum.
Right.
For artists and, you know, that type of thing. But it also looked like what was that thing where Chris Whitty's dad died in it? The British Council. It's that type of thing where they're trying to push a way of life onto people by throwing money at them, basically. The Congress aimed to enlist intellectuals and opinion makers in a war of ideas against communism, just like Orwell. British author and historian Francis Stoner Saunders writes in a 1999 book, whether they liked it or not, whether they knew it or not, there were few writers, poets, artists, historians, scientists, or critics in post-war Europe whose names were not in some way linked to this covert enterprise. The management of the CCF was entrusted to its secretariat, headed by Michael Jolison, who was a CIA agent.
It reminds you of that story that when Black Panthers were at the height, that there'd be groups of them and terror and groups of people, and they'd all be CIA agents. And there weren't actually a real guy in there.
Yeah,
all in secret from each other.
He recruited former communist intellectuals and Bloomsbury Group members like Bertrand Arthur William Russell, 3rd Earl Russell, a.k.a. Bertrand Russell. So he was a Bloomsbury Group, and he was recruited by the CIA agent. All this is covered in this 1999 book by Francis Stonor Saunders, who, the book was called, Who Paid the Piper? CIA and the Cultural War, Cold War, which I've just bought, and I started reading through it to get this information.
The Pollock book, will be in that.
Pardon?
I'm guessing Pollock will be in that, won't
it? I haven't read all of it, Chris, the book discusses the mid-20th century Central Intelligence Agency efforts to infiltrate and co-opt artistic movements using funds that were mostly channeled through the Congress of Cultural Freedom and the Ford Foundation.
Hail Ford.
Anti-Nazi, pro-Nazi. There you go. This is, again, Operation Mockingbird. This is it. That's what they did. You know, it's not just about having that newsreader, that Vanderbilt newsreader, Anderson Cooper, in front of you constantly. This is actually deeper than that, isn't it?
Because, well, he's just the one that got caught in it.
Yeah, that's blatant, isn't it?
Yeah.
Orwell published 3 books with this company, Secker and Warburg. Homage to Catalonia, 1938, Animal Farm, 1945, and 1984 in 1949. Huxley's wife sold the rights to Animal Farm to the CIA.
Right. Why?
So they could make that anti-communist animation film.
Ah, right. I remember seeing that as a kid. It blew my eyes out. You were in club against
it. Yeah, no, terrifying, wasn't it?
Yeah.
So the CIA funding, well, a cartoon, basically, that they're showing kids at school. They showed it as at school, that.
Yeah. Yeah. But that makes that as much...
That Watership Down.
Yeah, and on a surface level, that makes as much sense as Jackson Pollock, doesn't it?
Yes.
It's like, what?
I know. But even more sense, probably, because kids aren't going to go and look at Jacqueline Pollock. No. And they're the more open mind, aren't they? They're the mind.
But they're still doing the same thing, just on a load of free thinking modern art people, if you know what I mean.
Yes. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. The edgy. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And when you start seeing this, I mean, we've not got far into this, and we're already seeing a picture that you've got Sir this, Earl that, CIA this, Ford Foundation.
Yeah.
Book publishers who you wouldn't even think they're involved in anything, the Congress of Freedom and all this nonsense that are all funded and people working for them, CIA agents and what have you, and we haven't even started yet.
Yeah. Yeah, sorry, Orwell. He's up to his tits in it.
Yeah. and if you think about it, subverting a population is easy. I mean, just ask Yuri Bezmenov. I mean, he wrote it out, didn't he? Subverting... And undermining a population
20 years,
is
20 years to change everything.
20 years. I mean, how easy is it with a song? You just said you went to your mate's house, had a few beers, couldn't get a Beatles song out of your head. Mm. What that does then, it reminds you of that time. Mm. So these songs, although they're created by the CIA or these social controllers, you still can't get them out of your head.
Mm.
You know, when I hear Kung Fu Fighting, it reminds me of me and you running around. House dancing to Kung Fu Fighting, you know,
dressing gowns,
pretending we were judo outfits. Yeah, what a nice scene. Whether that is by distorting the truth via news agencies, etc., and then that goes on to change policies and attitudes, and you can see the domino effect falling and the pieces falling into place. And it don't matter to them it didn't quite work, that plan. Just do it again. Get more people, get more authors, get more actors, get more...
I mean, is the plan of 1984 that we can look at it and go, we're not quite there, we're not in... It's not as bad as 1984 yet.
Mm.
Was that the point of it? So, you know, we'll go, but 1984, I mean, that's bloody grim. That's proper fascism. We're not quite yet there. But I mean, we're actually in a worse state.
I'd say worse. I mean, just by telling us it's total surveillance means, even if it isn't, it means it is.
Mm. Yeah.
It requires a certain individual to do this work. The controllers need brown shirts, infiltrators, as Klaus Schwab said, have infiltrated the cabinets of the world. people who can stand in front of a camera like Boris Johnson and blatantly lie while saying, hand on heart, is telling the truth. These are the people, aren't they? These are who we're seeing.
Yeah, and your Wancocks.
And your Wancocks, your Tony Blairs. I mean, this is nothing new, has it? It's been going on for millennia. It's just become a lot more sophisticated as we and others have shown in this series and many other episodes, like our Sheep Farm three-part series on Sage that covered Spy B and Susan Mickey and her kind. That involved the Nudge Unit, a psychological terror that they've run on. We've seen it as a heightened terror during the last 3 years, but I think since 2001, how much they've used that 1984 terror, you know, after 7/7 and things like that. And we only have to look back to March 2020 to see how deeply the controllers have lobotomized or brainwashed the masses.
Mm.
That is a new plimsoll line, isn't it, for them?
Also,
it must be.
Each one of these events, like 9/11, 7/7, the last 3 years, each one of them is traumatizing every society.
Yes.
You know.
Mm. To levels that's never been done before.
But also, you're traumatizing the parents who are talking about it at home and the kids are hearing it, then it's passed down to there. You know, it's been a non-stop for the last 20 years when you think about it, from 9/11 to now. It's been non-stop.
Yeah.
Really.
Absolutely.
You had 9/11, then you had a series of miniature terrorist attacks, you know, which were suspect at the best.
Yeah.
And I think the same's happening with the recent 3 years.
Well, again, like the Twilight language, a terrorist attack means something else, doesn't it?
Yeah.
A terrorist attack probably means to them a direct attack on the population.
Terrorist attack on us.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's what it means. It doesn't mean that, you know, there's people out there wanting to get us. You know, it means his own government's going to get us.
Like we've said before, a virus is it a virus of a catching kind, or is it a virus that's spread throughout humanity?
Yeah.
Are these psychopaths?
Yeah, exactly.
I would hazard a guess it is.
Orwell wrote about the Ministry of Truth and then went on to work for the Information Research Department, or the IRD. He also presented propaganda during World War II for the BBC. During World War II, his wife, psychologist Eileen O'Shaughnessy, worked for the censorship department of the Ministry of Information. Are you thinking about Orwell like you did before now, Chris?
Not quite, no. Yeah. I mean, he even took those names, didn't he? Ministry of Truth and all that stuff.
Yeah.
Same name.
Yeah. We will cover this in more detail in these episodes. I've come to the realization now, Chris, any form of entertainment now has at least to be questioned, or I can't even question it anymore, but I'll fall on that side of it because I still want to leave the question there, but it's at least got to be questioned as control.
Yeah.
Because it's been infiltrated on every level.
They only need a few, look at Netflix, fight. They only need a few nuggets in there and it's propaganda.
Well, I mean, Netflix is a blatant piss take, isn't it? Because Edward Bernays's nephew. I mean, it's just a piss take, isn't it? It has to be.
And like I've always said, if you take Netflix and that Red Ryan and you put propaganda in there, it literally looks like
1984. It might as well just say 1984.
Did that used to exist where propaganda's written in like that writing in red with a black background? I'm pretty sure it does somewhere.
What is it? Entertainment? It means mind control. Elon Musk, Yuval Harari, all spring to mind as modern-day sort of shapeshifters of the Twilight language. Because if you look at Elon Musk and Yuval Harari, they're delivering bad news in a way that Aldous Huxley delivered it and George Orwell.
What is Yuval Harari's standpoint, Fire? Because my son just read one of his early books, and I thought that was interesting because I was telling him, that guy's Dodger. He's World Economic Forum. And he's like, no, I've read his, I think he's read his first one. And he was saying, no, no, it's just about an alternative version of history. Yeah. So I think that that first, because he was telling me what was in it, and he didn't sound too, you know, eugenicist, if you like. Mm. And I'm thinking he used that one to drag people in.
Yeah.
And what's it? What's his stance, that guy? Do you know?
Well, he's warning people that,
overpopulation,
by telling them what's going to happen about with AI and stuff like that, which is not dissimilar from what Orwell were doing.
Yeah. Yeah.
They're bringing bad news, but pretending that they're warning you about it all while working for World Economic Forum or security agencies.
Yeah. He's not warning it, yeah. But even that AI thing, which is massive now, isn't it? It's everywhere about AI this, AI that.
Yeah.
They're literally reaching that point of Terminator.
Yeah.
And even that word AI, artificial, they're telling you that it's artificial. Yeah. So it doesn't exist.
No.
It's just a data collection thing that, the data will be the intelligence. So it's artificial. It's not real. It doesn't exist, does it?
No.
But how much of that are you seeing in the you know, presses? And it's everywhere now, isn't it?
It's everywhere. I mean, again, the Great Reset before 2020, if you look at what's new now, you know, all these things like droughts and things like that, all these things are, they're utilizing these now.
That's the Great Reset. We've changed the news feed, and now it's AI.
Newspeak.
Yeah. Global climate warming. I mean, that alarm thing, you know.
Yeah. But that is all 1984 stuff, isn't it?
Yeah, to be afraid of forest fires and floods. When have they ever bothered us? Never.
I mean, if you look at the newscasters here in the UK, like Jeremy Vine, James O'Brien, Mariana Spring, Anna Fry, Brian Cocker, and in America, Anderson Vanderbilt, CIA Cooper. You know, all these people. Who were that guy that interviewed Bin Laden in that cave, and he got there before CIA? I mean, does anybody really believe that nonsense? Yeah. I mean, he worked for CNN, who's started by Ted Turner, who's a eugenicist, and obviously, the whole thing is just a setup from start to finish. I can't believe any of it now. It is like a science fiction. Like you're reading Terminator. That's what you're doing.
Can it be any coincidence that O'Brien?
It's called O'Brien. Yeah.
O'Brien from 1984. I mean, is that a coincidence?
Looking into it, far too much. Operation Mockingbird, Project MKUltra, Operation Cauldron, like Operation 2020, aren't they? Operation 2020 Divock.
Mm.
They're still in operation. They're still going. They've just been finessed, haven't they?
Yeah, exactly.
One thing's becoming clearer. Orwell and his work and his ilk were security assets.
Yeah, it's pretty obvious now, isn't it?
It's pretty obvious, and we hadn't even got started.
And we had this conversation about 2 or 3 years ago, I think. Well, probably long, but even before the nonsense, actually.
Yeah.
About Orwell.
Yeah.
Because we both had the suspicions, I think.
Well, I had my suspicions, and it's nice where it links into the Huxley stuff, the Brave New World Order. That's why I had to do more work on this, because he was taught at Eton by Aldous Huxley. And, you know,
again, that's one of them nuggets that people fire out without any
connections or...
No disrespect to him, but yeah, without any... He needed more looking into it, didn't it?
Well, his main teacher, one of his main teachers, ASF Gowie, were called. He was another one of the aspiring in Soviet super spies.
Right.
And he's his teacher. He was his mentor. He was his teacher at Eton. And then he ended, anyway, we'll come to that, but all these things is, when you look at coincidences, he knows all these people, right, that are all linked back to intelligence, and then he's writing about the same stuff. I mean, and there's another story about his first wife, which when you hear that, you'll go, about 1984, right, but I'm not going to tell it now, we'll wait for that. Born Eric Arthur Blair, better known by his pen name or undercover intelligence alter ego name, George Orwell 007, and that's a name we'll use from now on, was an English novelist, essayist, journalist, and critic, and intelligence agent. That's me adding that bit, by the way. His work is categorized by social criticism, opposition to totalitarianism, and support of democratic socialism. Now, that sounds like World Economic Forum, You will own nothing and be very happy. Mm. He's known for his books Animal Farm and 1984. Thanks for tuning in. We'll see you next time. Bye.
Bye.